This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In Perek Dalet, in the fourth Perek, we began Eliphaz's tackling of ears. And we discussed Eliphaz's technique, how he doesn't commiserate with Eeyore, he tackles him head on, and he attacks him. And he basically says, the fact that you cave in after one little bit of hardship indicates that you're not really a maimin, that you don't really believe in Hashem. You haven't really suffered such a hard time, it's only been a short period of time, and even though it's been very severe, it hasn't gone on, and this isn't the time for you to be caving in already. And therefore you probably deserve what you're getting. And in the fifth chapter, he's going to question Eve's developing thesis that there is a force outside of the Ribbono Shel Olam that governs the world. Quite apart from God's will, God has so programmed the world, Eve is beginning to think, that there are things that happen even though they're not directly willed by God himself, by the Ribbono Shel Olam. The system is willed by Hashem, the program is willed by Hashem, that the actual event might not be willed by Hashem. That's the idea that's developing in Eeyore's mind. And that's the only way he's able to cope with this enormous contradiction. Here's a righteous man suffering at the hands of a righteous, omnipotent God. Something's wrong. So all he's saying is, yes, God is righteous, and I'm a righteous man, that's all fine. But nature is nature. Things can happen. There are coincidences. There are all sorts of things that can happen that are beyond the direct will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Eliphaz is very unhappy and very uncomfortable with this. And he begins to tackle that. And again, he hits Eve really hard in his opening sentence. Krono, he says to Eve, call out to Hashem. And then we can just imagine, if you look at the trop also of that pasuk, it will assist that imagination. One can just imagine a couple of moments silence after Eliphaz says that. Krono, Eve, call out to God, call to Hashem. Silence. Hayesho necho? Did anybody answer you? Ve'elmi mikadoshim tifne. And to who among the holy ones, meaning the angels and the powers and spirits, could you turn? To whom do you have access? You, Eeyore of the righteous man. You, Eeyore of the big tzaddik. Call out to Hashem. Let's hear if he answers you. Call out. Let's see if some angel comes and talks to you. What communication do you have with God if you're so terribly righteous? He says, the reason nobody answers you is, ki le'evil yaharog koas. This parak, I want to take the sentences fairly carefully, the wording fairly carefully. Because an evil is a person who questions God and questions his the hashgacha, God's ability, the extent to which God controls the world. Yaharog kwas, he is killed by anger. Ufoise. And a Pesi is a person who believes in God. He's just weak-charactered. So although he believes in God, sometimes he just he gets persuaded to do the wrong thing. Tomis Kino, he gets killed by jealousy. That's a very wonderful sentence, and let's just analyze and understand it. Eliphaz says there are two kinds of people, two attitudes that bring people to doing wrong. The one is incorrect beliefs, and the other is weak character. Those are the only two reasons a person can do wrong. You either don't believe you don't have a value system which is accurate, and therefore you believe that the things you're doing are okay, or you know they're not okay, but still you do them. Weak character, one is tempted, one does it, and one knows that it's not right. Those are the two. The first type, the person who doesn't have the right value system, ultimately gets killed by anger. And the anger that he's talking about is this person's own anger. Anger is something that is a function of lack of emunah. And the Gemara is like that, if a person gets angry, it's as if he serves idolatry. What's the relationship? Because there isn't really a place for anger if there's a strong belief. What are you getting angry at? One gets angry when one feels out of control. But if you're out of control and somebody else is in control, then there's no real reason to get angry if you believe in the ultimate goodness of he who is in control. Again, when we're in control, we don't feel angry. When we feel we're on top of things and we're controlling things, we don't get angry. When do we get angry? When things are on top of us. And we would like to be able to control them and we can't. That's when we get angry. If things are on top of us, but the things that are on top of us are being controlled by Hashem, and we believe in the absolute perfection and justice and mercy and kindness of Hashem, then there's nothing to get angry about. It's true that we're not in control, but look who is in control. It's like the example I gave in one of the other shiurim, when you're sitting in the plane and the plane's bumping all over the place, there's no point in getting angry. There's a pilot who's in control, he's competent, he's qualified. You don't have to get angry about the fact that you're not in control. Somebody better than you in control. What do you have to worry about? So we don't just get angry when we're not in control. We only get angry when we're not in control and we have no confidence in the forces that are in control. That's when we start getting angry. So the person who suffers from anger, the person who's aggressive in the sense of anger, the area, the way to handle anger is to work on emunah. The way to handle anger is not the psychologists used to say, they're beginning to change their minds now, that anger needs to be vented. You need to get rid of it. You need to express it. And this is an interesting debate right now at the moment. People are saying that you've got to allow these people to vent their angers. And there's another school of thought that says, but what kind of civilization can you have if you allow people to vent their angers? Every time you get angry, must you throw a stone at somebody's shop? Do you shoot somebody when you get angry to vent your anger? But that is in fact a logical continuation of a whole school of the upbringing of children. There's a whole school of thought started a long time ago by Dr. Spock. I don't know if it was started by him, but it was certainly popularized by him, on which a whole generation of people were raised. And that is, you must let a child express his anger and get over it, and it doesn't matter if he tears your furniture to pieces and so on. These are things you've got to do. And there is something in that. There is something in that, certainly when a child is developing. There's a Gemara that says that you should buy your children, your children, old crockery so that they can break it. In other words, what is the Gemara saying? Yes, there is an anger that needs to be vented, but you've got to train the child to vent his anger on objects that are not damaging somebody else, that isn't going to cost somebody else. So you give him the things to break. Fine, so he gets it out of himself and he breaks it. It's okay. We have another concept like that a person... In Hilchos Shabbos this comes up, that if a person does something destructive when he's a mourner, when he's just heard that he's lost a dear one, and he does something destructive, in terms of Hilchos Shabbos, that's considered constructive. Because he's venting his anger, he's getting something out. So we do things, that's why we do Kriya. There are actions that we do which are there in order to vent anger. Venting anger is okay, with one proviso, not at somebody else's expense. You've got anger to vent? Yes, you need to be able to vent it. But that doesn't entitle you to damage somebody else or to hurt somebody else, whether to hurt them verbally or to hurt them materially. And this is such a simple concept, but it's one which isn't really understood by people at all. People say either the two options are, do you vent your anger or don't you? Must you stifle it? And everybody knows stifling is bad, so therefore the answer must be you must allow people to vent their anger. And people are battling with this. As I said, particularly now in terms of the whole national thing that's going on, the whole political thing that's going on, people are battling with it. What is the right thing to do? The right thing is to vent your anger, but never at the expense of somebody else. You don't have the right to vent your anger at somebody else's expense. And venting anger, all the venting anger does is it gets over the immediate tension. But it doesn't solve the cause of the anger. Something's making you angry. It doesn't help you, encouraging people to vent their anger in the belief that by venting their anger, they're actually going to be okay afterwards. They're going to be okay enough to talk to them. They'll be okay enough to reason with them. But you haven't solved the problem. Something made them angry in the first place. And here we come to a complete divergence with any other psychological approach. So the psychologist would say, right, let's figure out what made him angry. His husband made her angry. His wife made him angry. His parents made him angry. His customers made him angry. His boss made him angry. Kais is a function of lack of emunah. That's where anger comes from. Anger comes from not relaxing, not believing that the boss is in charge. That's all. You get angry when you think there are forces on top of you over which you have no control, nor does anybody better than you have any control. That's when you get angry. But when you realize, nothing to get angry about. Nothing to get angry about. When Yishalom has it all in control, that's it. Then there's a kind of tranquility that one can achieve. And so if we're going to treat anger at its root, the area to treat it is an emunah. Which opens up enormous ideas and concepts, and very disturbing ones. That means that without religion you cannot treat aggression. Very interesting idea, isn't it? Religion and psychology and what comes out here is that aggression in people cannot be treated without religion. That doesn't mean that religion automatically solves it. It's got to be the right kind of religion and the right kind of attitude to religion. Sometimes religion makes people even more angry. It depends what their whole perception of the Ribbono Shel Olam is and their whole understanding of God. But what we're saying is that the link between psychology and religion is in fact so tight that without emunah, without an understanding of Hashgacha, of an understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam being in charge, and a picture of Hashem and an understanding of Hashem and a relationship with Hashem, you can't treat the cause of anger. Because that's the cause of anger. The cause of anger is not the husband or the mother-in-law or the wife or the parent or the boss. The cause of the anger is an inability to cope because of a lack of understanding that things are going okay, that there's a balabos in charge, that things are, that there is some kind of direction. And the result of that is harigo, the result of that is killing. And it works both ways. The person himself is likely to get killed because when anger starts, this one starts killing that one, another one starts killing that, kind of things we were worried about only a few hours ago. And that's what happens with chaos. If one's going to allow aggression to get out of hand, the result of that is harigo, the result of that is death. Ufose tomiskino, but the other kind of person, the weak-charactered person, he dies of jealousy. He doesn't die of anger, he doesn't get angry. He has emunah, he has bitochen, he has total trust in Hashem. He knows Hashem is in charge, he feels close to Hashem, he doesn't get angry, he doesn't get aggressive. That doesn't mean he's a tzaddik yet. He might be re-charactered, as we all are, at different times. Just depends how strong the temptation is. There's a point at which it's difficult to withstand. And he dies not from anger and aggression, he dies from kino. Now you might say you've never heard of a person dying from jealousy. You've heard people dying of cancer and of heart attacks and of tumors and all sorts of things. Never heard of somebody dying of jealousy. That's in fact not so. Back again to the root cause of the cancers and the heart attacks and the tumors and the everything. Jealousy. Go and work out what really eats people up. What really destroys them. And disease is when the body just can't take the pressures. What kind of pressures? Not the external pressures. The external pressures the body can handle. The body was designed to handle external pressures. All the body wasn't designed to handle is the way we mishandle ourselves. And we, all the coughing that goes on inside us, the things we get resentful about, the things we get upset about, the things we plot and scheme about, what's it all generated by? By jealousy of one form or another. Dissatisfaction with our situation, dissatisfaction with what we've got, a belief that the grass is greener on the other side, the South African melody that we discussed in the Motzei Shabbos Shir, that it can be the most beautiful, the most beautiful country, the most beautiful society, but South African Jews have a tendency, and have had for years and years and years, of believing it must be better somewhere else, it is better somewhere else, and then they go somewhere else and then they still believe that it must be better somewhere else. That's an internal thing, that's not something external, that's something within ourselves that we're driven by kino, we're driven by a dissatisfaction, we're driven by, and there are two types of dissatisfactions. One can, if one is satisfied, one stagnates. So there's a positive dissatisfaction, but that's a dissatisfaction with oneself. Dissatisfaction with oneself is positive. Dissatisfaction with one's circumstances is negative. If I sit and I say to myself, I'm not satisfied with the effort I'm putting in. I'm not satisfied with the progress I've made. I'm not satisfied with the amount of money I've made even. Well, that's quite positive, because the result of that is to do better. But when we start, I'm not satisfied with my boss, I'm not satisfied with my workers, I'm not satisfied with the government, I'm not satisfied with the economy, I'm not, all external things that we're not satisfied. That's kina. That the body can't handle. That becomes too heavy. Because we start substituting the whole world for ourselves, and we start taking on all the worries of the world, and we start seeing in all of the different aspects of our existence, we start seeing our sorrows and our problems. That's the kina. Jealousy doesn't just mean I'm jealous of so-and-so. One has to see kina as something much wider. Kina is a general malaise, a general dissatisfaction with life and with circumstances. And you see kina on people's faces. And when you see kina on people's faces, it's not the aggressive, ambitious look on the face. That's not kina. It's that general unhappy, miserable, depressed, moaning, groaning kind of face. That's the kina. The person is just dissatisfied with what he's got. We had a rabbi who came from Israel the first time, and he came to see us this afternoon. And the first thing he said to me is, "What a country! What a beautiful place to live!" Only one little problem. Good, you've got this little problem to sort out. But what a place! Different perception. Didn't dream that it was anything like this. Didn't dream there was a place like this in the world. That's his reaction when he comes here. And we were living here busy wondering how to get out on the next plane. Different perceptions. Kina. It's something one has to check, one has to question all the time. Is it dissatisfaction with circumstances, or is it dissatisfaction with oneself? Is there the emunah and the bitokhin? Is there the strength of character to be able to see it through? Do you want to ask anything, Paul? Because he's weak character. Weak character, that means intellectually he understands, and he knows that's the way it should be. But the fact is, he gets easily tempted. What is he tempted by? What does temptation mean? It means I believe that if I do that which I know I oughtn't to, I will feel better. Isn't that so? Otherwise, why would he do it? That's weak character. The belief that there's something outside of you that can make you feel better. One makes... It's almost the thread that one needs to cross in order to become a tzaddik is the knowledge that there is nothing outside of you that can make you feel better. And in fact, there's nothing outside of you that can make you feel worse. Whether you're going to feel better or worse depends on you. It's all in you. There's nothing outside of you that can affect the way you feel. There are things that can hurt you physically, and there are things that can hurt you materially. There are all sorts of things that can hurt you externally. That nothing outside can affect the way you're feeling. And that's Eliphaz's whole thing here. Don't blame outside circumstances. This is the battle that's going on between Eov and Eliphaz. Eov is saying, I'm a tzaddik, I know, but there are external factors that affect my happiness. There are external factors that affect the way people feel, and therefore the way they respond. Because we respond according to our feelings. Eliphaz is saying, rubbish. There is nothing external that affects the way you feel. Yes, people die. Why do they die? Because of chaos. Where does the chaos come from? Because they're evilim. They're not angry because they inherited anger from their parents. They're not angry because somebody outside made them angry. They're not angry because their constellational forces brought about a time of anger. They're angry because they've chosen not to believe in Hashem properly. And yes, you'll find people dying of jealousy. And why are they jealous? Because they've chosen to be weak character. They've chosen to believe that there are things outside of them that can affect their happiness. That's their choice. And your feelings are your choice. That's the important thing to understand. The way you want to feel about anything is your choice. You want to love somebody, that's your choice. You want to hate somebody, that's your choice. You want to enjoy your life, that's your choice. You want to find it miserable, that's your choice. You want to think South Africa is going down the tubes, that's your choice. You want to think there's a potential for future, that's your choice. We're not talking about knowledge. Knowledge is determined by facts. And we don't always know the facts. But feelings are not determined by facts. Feelings are determined by perceptions. By the way you choose to view the facts. That's what determines your feelings. So you can come out of today's experience feeling depressed, and you can come out of today's experience as feeling elated. Same facts. 8 people killed, 250,000 people marched. Same facts. One person can say, oi, this is the end. And another person can say, my goodness, how unbelievably wonderful. Same facts, different perceptions. Which perception you want to choose, that's your choice. And that's what Eliphaz is saying. It's modern stuff, isn't it? Aniro isi evil mashrish. Don't think, says Eov in the third pasuk, says Eliphaz, that I don't know that it can happen that an evil, a person who doesn't believe in Hashem, might do well. I've seen plenty of people also, who are non-believers, who are wicked people, and I've seen the mashrish taking root and being productive and becoming wealthy. I've also seen that. But I say when I see that, that they're doomed, that people who have developed assets, status, suddenly are doomed. Yirchaku vanov miyesha. Their children will be distanced from salvation. The yidaku vashar ve'in matzu. And they might be oppressed at the courts, and there'll be nobody to save them. In other words, you've got to have a long-term view. The fact that somebody suddenly becomes wealthy, that doesn't mean anything. He can suddenly lose his money too. What's important is it there to stay? Are his children going to have it? Are his grandchildren going to have it? Are his great-grandchildren going to have it? Is there some permanence in what he's achieved? And that says Eliphaz, and that ties back to Perek Dalet, to the previous chapter as well. That says Eliphaz, I say, doesn't exist. Quick wealth, yes, but not permanent quick wealth. If a person's just got it, even though he's an evil, even though he's a non-believer and a wicked person, it's not there to last. Asher k'tziroi ro'ev yoichel. I'm translating it according to the Malbim and the Ikrim, which is very different to the English translation in front of you. The English translation takes it that he curses them that this may be, which is not the way we're learning it. We're learning it that he's giving his philosophy, his understanding of what will be. Asher k'tziroi ro'ev yoichel. He who eats his harvest hungry. What does that mean? A beautiful image. There are two kinds of people. There's the kind of person who, when he harvests his field and eats it, he's already satisfied before he harvests it because he's been eating all the way through. What's he been eating? He's been dealing and wheeling and dealing. He's been, even though the produce is not there yet, he's been waiting for the produce, but he's been stealing, in other words. He's been taking things that don't belong to him, and he's been eating as well. That's not the person Eliphaz is talking about. He's talking about Asher k'tziroi, a man who eats his harvest ro'ev in hunger, because for months he's had very little to eat. He's been waiting for his harvest to come, and he hasn't touched anything that wasn't his. So he's been living on his reserves until the new harvest becomes available. Ve'al mitzinim yikocheyu, and he sorts out. He has to weed, and he separates it, and works hard at his parnosa. Ve'sho'af tzamim cheilom. I see such a person drinking like water the wealth of the others, of the people who are developing who became wealthy suddenly. Let's just do another two psukim before we discuss it. Ki lo yetze me'ofor oven, because dishonesty does not get produced from the earth. U'me'adomo lo yitzmach omo. And From earth, there does not grow also the forms of deceit and non-productivity. Let's talk a second. I'm just going to see the Malbim on that. I think the way the Malbim takes it is Lo Yitzmach Omol, the earth will not produce produce of work if it has been developed deceitfully. What is he saying? Ki odom le'omol yulod, because man has been born to work. Uvnei reshef yagbihu uf, and the spiritual powers fly way up. This also Zion. This Pasuk Zion is so important in so many different ways. Firstly, it's the kind of sentence that the Kabbalists down the road must have to learn. What is life about? Ki odom le'omel yulod. Life is about being productive. Life is about working. That's what it is. That's the bottom line of it all. And working is really very simple. Working means producing. Working means being creative. Uvnei reshef, and these upper spirits, yagbihu, if they can fly in the sky, they're not for us. That's not our area. Our area is omal. Our area is work. And Chazal discussed that statement in many different ways. And one of the things that the Chazal make clear is that work, it's our choice whether or in what area we want to work. We can work in the spiritual area and we can work in the material area, in the physical area. We can be productive in business, we can be productive in the professions, and we can be productive in Torah. But it isn't possible, it isn't moral, nor is it ultimately possible for the human being to escape the role of omal, of toil, of work. And therefore says, if you have any attempt to become wealthy without work, is not going to lead to any kind of result. There are many people, even in Gedolei Yisrael, who take lottery tickets. These lottery tickets they buy, once a week they buy a lottery ticket. And their reasoning is, in case Hashem wants me to be wealthy, you know, we've got to give him the opportunity, you can't rely on miracles. So once a week they take it, just in case Hashem wants them to be wealthy. I've never heard of one of them winning. You hear all sorts of funny people winning. I've tried all these competitions and all these things. I've never won it. And I don't know of any from people really who do well on these things. Why is that? Speculation. Very seldom that you find from people doing well in purely speculative deals. Why is that? Hashem designed the world so that we should earn our living from doing something productive. Not from chance. Not from games, not from sports. It's does something. One has to do something productive. There's a man I know, he's a customer of mine in Durban, and he spends a lot of money on horses. And I always, before I go to see him, I always make inquiries: has he just won or has he just lost? If he's just lost, I don't even go and see him. If he's just won, then we usually do some nice business. But altogether, is he winning or is he losing? Coming out square. Really coming out square. Not winning, up and down and up and down. The world wasn't designed to make money out of non-productive ways. Yes, it can happen. A stroke of good fortune. But that's the point that Eliphaz makes. But that doesn't last. That's not spiritual. That's not wealth of brocha. That's not wealth that comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Something that you're playing around with and you've got it for a little while. That's not something you're blessed with. You're blessed with something you've produced. You're blessed with something that is the result of your creating something for which you get some kind of benefit. Whether you're creating a service, or you're creating goods, or you're creating ideas, it doesn't matter. As long as there's something that you're creating and the income you gain from that is the fruits of your labors. You've labored, you've worked, you've been creative, you've applied yourself, and the result of that is you get something in. That's the essence key. Odom le'omal yulod. Man has been created to work. It's very interesting and very important to understand why it is that the human being is the only creature that was created to work. The animals, Hashem gives them their panosa very easily. And even those that have to work a little bit for it, some animals are luckier than others. Some animals have the kind of panosa, and they don't have to work. The grazers, they just wander around and they eat. And sometimes there's famine, sometimes there's not much to drink around, not much to eat around, they suffer a little bit, but generally they don't have to go working terribly hard to get their food compared to the lions, let's say. And really, it's very hard work for them. And they're not always successful. They put a lot of energy and a lot of skill into getting their food. But none of the animals get their food by doing something productive. It's true, we have productive animals. We have cows, we have oxen, we have horses that pull carts. We have productive animals. But they don't get their food from being productive. Their food is one thing, and because man uses them, they become productive in the way that man uses them. But they themselves are not productive. And there is no relationship between their productivity and their income. Their income is guaranteed. And their productivity is not at all. There's virtually no productivity. They're like government workers. And it's interesting how often there's a tendency among people to opt for that kind of panosarod. People, we talked on Saturday night about people who just feel secure where they are, who are not willing to look ahead, who are not willing to... it's interesting to note also that those are not the people that ever make money. It's true that they're also not the people who ever lose money. But not losing money is no kunst when you never made any. Who are the people who make the money? Are the people who do look at the end, who do look ahead, who are willing to move forward. But there's a reason for that also, because the person who's not willing to move off secure ground, he wants to live like an animal. He wants a salary. So he wants to know that at the end of the month, he's got a salary check. Very comforting feeling. It's as comfortable as being a behemoth, well, you know, grazing around in the fields. But that's not what the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted from human beings. He wanted you to get a salary check at the end of the month only if you were productive. That's what he wants. He doesn't want you to have a salary check at the end of the month if you weren't productive. In fact, if you weren't productive and you get a salary check at the end of the month, Hashem has a name for that. He calls that stealing. That's what he calls that. We don't call that stealing, we call it our rights. It's my salary. What does a salary mean? It's the grass that I graze. Hashem gave it to me as my right. You don't have such a right. All you have a right is to being paid if you've done something contributive. If you've created something. If you've used your skills, you've used your mind, you've used your ability, and you've created something, then you're entitled to panosa. Ki odom le'omal yulod. Man, unlike animals, was created to be productive. And being productive is enormously energy absorbing. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of personality, but the rewards are enormous. One feels different. One operates differently. One's financial rewards are very often differently. That's what man was created for. And that's all the philosophy. When you think of how much philosophy has been wasted on trying to figure out the purpose of man, and this, here you go. Purpose of man, work. Just get on with the job. Philosophize afterwards. Somebody told me today of a school in Natal. I wish we could take it over and turn it into a film school. I'd never heard about it before. The kids do half a day, say their work, half a day their studies. That's a high school. They get good matrics. And the other half a day they work on a farm. And it's their own farm, and that farm has to be, it's a government school. That farm has to be productive. That farm has to make a profit. They work, they slave. They start at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they go through till late at night. But they're working with the physical things. They need to be productive, and they understand. They don't sit around philosophizing about the purpose of life and should they take drugs or shouldn't they take drugs. And it's irrelevant. There's a job. They have to work. People are very healthy when they're being productive. They don't have a lot of health problems that don't exist, and there's certainly all these emotional and psychological problems that don't exist, because that's how God made us, to be productive. And if we're not productive, we feel the results of it. We feel the effects of it. We've been made to work. And when we're working, then the spiritual powers, they fly away. They're irrelevant to us. Then we've got our lives in our own control. Then we've determined. Then we decide. Then we master our own existences. If we're going to sit around not being creative, if we're going to sit around not working, then of course we're going to be affected by all sorts of forces. That we have the opportunity to take our lives into our own hands if we'll follow the maxim of Ki Odom Le'omal Yulad. And therefore, says Eliphaz Ulam, Ani Edrosh El Keil Ve'el Elokim Osim Divrosi. I don't look at all sorts of outside forces. As far as I'm concerned, there are two forces. Man and God. Those are the forces. Hashem has certain plans, and Hashem acts, and Hashem has controls. And man takes decisions and man makes decisions. And those are the only forces. Hashem sets my circumstances, I set my attitudes. And that's it. And the combination of those two is all that governs my life. I can't change my circumstances, Hashem governs them. I can change my attitudes. And my attitudes are in my control. And this Hashem, the power of the Ribbono Shel Olam, his omnipotence, there's no way one can analyze it. Niflo yisad en mispol, the wonders he does exceed any ability to count them. Hanoisein motor al pnei oretz, he brings water, he brings rain onto the earth. V'sholeach mayim al penei chutzos, and he sends water by means of rivers to the outlying places that don't get rain. So the first wonderful thing is to realize that the Ribbono Shel'olam divides the world up into different areas. There are rainfall areas, and there are places that are watered with rivers. And there are places that aren't watered at all, and they're not meant to be inhabited. And if there's no water there, it's a sign that that's not a place where one is meant to be living. But there's more wonder in that. The giving of rain. Why is Matar Al Panei Haaretz, giving rain, so important? And why does it show the wonders of Hashem? Losum Shefolim Lamorum, which literally means to allow vegetation to grow up high. So the uplifting of vegetation comes from the application of the rain to it. Pickles and humans are saved from drying out, from overheating. That's the role of rain. It provides irrigation for plants, and it provides refreshment for human beings and animals. That's what Hashem does. But that phrase, Losum Shefolim Lamorum, has another meaning to it as well. To uplift lowly people, to uplift depressed people. Shofel means a person who's down under. And to uplift Losum Shefolim Lamorum, to bring them up on high. How does that work? And that is that there's a moral value in rain as well. The Medrash says in Bereishis that the Ribbono Shel Olam decided after the Chet of Adam HaRishon that the world should be irrigated by rainfall, not by the normal natural means. And rain is the only thing that is unpredictable. It doesn't follow any set sort of cycle. You don't know next year how much rain there'll be. There's no way. That's absolutely impossible to have an idea of how much rain there'll be. Every year is different. Every season is different. Every day is different. It doesn't follow any kind of set pattern, because that brings a certain morality into the world. The knowledge that at the end of the day we are dependent on something that we can't control. And of course the next step is just to go that one step further and say, then who does control it? Hashem controls it. If we don't want to believe that Hashem controls it, okay. It's our own perceptions again. We can choose what perception we want to take. But in the bringing of rain, it's not just that Hashem irrigates the world. Hashem has chosen to irrigate the world with a method that ensures the retention of a degree of spirituality and morality in people. Mefer machshavos arumim. This Hashem sometimes does interfere. Sometimes we have plans and Hashem undoes them. No matter how bright we are, Hashem sometimes chooses to undo those plans. And the hands of the planners don't bring those plans into actuality. Sometimes that happens. But sometimes Hashem does something else interesting. Sometimes He lets these clever people develop their plan, but He destroys them with their own plans. And the ideas of these crooked people is actually speeded up. And the Malbim gives two examples. These are two different ways that Hashem handles man's plans if He doesn't approve of them. The one way is he destroys the plans. For example, the Malbim gives the lovely case of Achitophel, who gave advice to Avshalom. And Achitophel, the Tanakh says Achitophel was so brilliant that asking advice from Achitophel was like having a direct line to God. He was always right. He just had this perception. He had this brilliance. And Achitophel gave Avshalom some advice which would have resulted in the destruction of David. And for the most amazing reasons, Avshalom doesn't take the advice. Which was weird. It's ridiculous not to take Achitophel's advice. But he didn't. So the whole plan doesn't get carried out. That's the one way Hashem works. The other example is Yosef and his brothers. The brothers planned to sell Yosef as a slave. Not a nice thing to do. Hashem wasn't too pleased with it, but he allowed it to happen. The only thing is, he got the brothers into trouble because of that. Their own plan turned against them. So sometimes Hashem interferes with the plan and actually cancels it. Sometimes Hashem helps it along, but the initiators of the plan sometimes land up being the sufferers of the plan rather than the people that they had originally directed them towards. So he acknowledges, Eliphaz acknowledges, that there are times that Hashem interferes. Why is that? And how does it happen? Yomom yifagshu choshech. Sometimes what appeared like daytime meets them in darkness. In other words, that's the image for the cancellation of the plans. They think it's day, they plan, they go out into the day, and it just gets dark. V'chalaylo yamashishu b'tzorayim. But sometimes it is in the daytime. Yet they wander around as if it's dark. V'yosham yicherev mipihem miyad chazok evyoin. And that way, Hashem saves weak people from their swords. V'atehi ladal tikvo. And there is hope that way for the poor person. Corruption and degeneracy has its mouth closed. So the Eve says, if Hashem would leave life totally in the hands of human choice, then there would be no hope for weak people. Then it would be the law of the jungle. So sometimes it's necessary for Hashem to intercede in order to protect the weak people. Two ways that he does that. Sometimes he does that by making the aggressors the victims of their own plans, and sometimes he cancels their plans altogether. So there are times, Eliphaz acknowledges, when Hashem will interfere, but that's only when a person's plans are directed against innocent people who are too weak to defend themselves. When that happens, Hashem interferes. And since you understand that there is that kind of interference, then a person must feel gratified when Hashem punishes them. And don't despise the Musar of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are two kinds of the rebuke. The one is what we call Toichocho, and the other is Musar. Toichocho comes from the word Lohichiach, which means to prove, to show, to demonstrate. Sometimes you punish a person in anticipation to show him that what he is about to do isn't such a good idea. That's one kind of suffering that is caused to people. And the other is musa, which comes from pain, from hurting, where you hurt a person for something he's already done to show him that it wasn't the right thing to do. So it happens. Sometimes Hashem does do things which a human being didn't choose. Hashem punishes. We didn't choose the punishment. But it is a result of something we've done. Ki hu yach'iv v'yechbosh. Because Hashem causes pain sometimes by the very bandage He puts around you. Sometimes the healing process is in itself painful. Yimchatz v'yodov tirpeno. While He applies pressure, your hands are being healed. So one needs to know sometimes the pressure's on and one feels the pain, but it's a healing process. It's not a destructive process. It's a healing process. B'sheish tzores yatzileko. Sometimes He saves you with six tzores. You have six tragedies, and you think, oh, one after the other, six of them it can be. U'v'sheva lo yiga b'choro, in order that you should escape the seventh. For example, b'ro podcho mimovis. He might cause you hunger, which makes you emigrate or move to another area, and by that you save from death, because there's some calamity which comes upon the place where you were. How does he get you out of where you are? It's a choice he wants you to make. So he brings family, brings hardship, and you move because there's hardship. And sometimes through war you are saved from being slaughtered. Because there's war, you take care of yourself, you don't go to certain places, or if you do go, you go properly armed because you think there's a war on. And as a result of that, you can find yourself being saved because you were prepared from a bandit that would otherwise have got you. So you're there, you are cursing the wall, and why is it, and why is it? But you don't realize it's all there in order to protect you. Sometimes a person destroys you with his tongue, and that might result in your being put into prison, but that in itself might save you from other things that are going on. And therefore, while you're there, while you've been locked up for no crime that you've committed, you're able to laugh at all sorts of other tragedies that are happening, and the wild animals of the earth, some of them on two legs, some of them on four legs, al tiro, you don't have to worry about, because you're safe, and you think it's a terrible calamity, you've been locked up in jail. Hashem wants you there because it's the safest place for you to be right there. All of these are images where you can't know, where things that seem so terrible to you might be protecting you. To to the point where the stones of the field, you've made a deal with it, they don't hurt you, and the animals of the field have made peace with you. That's Eliphaz's broad picture that another four or so took him at the end of the parak, which we'll do next week before we carry on with the with Perek Vov, which is Eeyore's answer to Eliphaz. Eeyore's not just going to accept it so easily from Eliphaz either. But the point to which we've come is Eeyore saying there are forces outside of me which determine my future, which determine what happens to me, and which impact on my happiness and my feelings. Eliphaz saying there is no such thing. There is nothing outside of you that impacts on your feelings and that impacts on your future. There are a few exceptions to that. Sometimes Hashem interferes. If you've got plans that are destructive for other people, Hashem might interfere with those plans. And sometimes Hashem punishes you, but it's for things that you've done, and you should be grateful for that punishment. And sometimes it's not for things that you've done, it's to protect you from things that are worse. And it feels like punishment to you, it feels like suffering to you, but in fact He's protecting you from worse calamities. That's the thesis that Eliphaz starts. So we have two opposite theses of the cause of suffering. Is the cause outside the human being, or is the cause inside the human being? Has God abandoned certain processes to the forces of nature, or does He keep control carefully, and has He given us control of our own lives? Those are the two views that Eve and Eliphaz have both put, and these views are going to be worked out and worked through and analyzed and debated between them all, as well as several other views which are going to be added into the picture, which we haven't yet had, which are all going to go into the process of resolving this enormous conflict that plagues Eve until the closing chapters.